glory will be raised. Then, though too weak to tread the ways of truth, this age fall back to old idolatry, though men return to servitude as fast as the tide ebbs, to ignominy and shame by nations sink together, we shall still find solace in the knowledge which we have, blessed with true happiness, if we may be united helpers, forward of a day, a firmer trust, joint labourers in a work, should Providence such grace to us vouchsafe, of their redemption, surely yet to come. Prophets of nature, we to them will speak a lasting inspiration, sanctified by reason and by truth. What we have loved, others will love, and we may teach them how, instruct them, how the mind of man becomes 1,000 times more beautiful than the earth on which he dwells, above this frame of things, which mid all revolutions in the hopes and fears of men doth still remain unchanged, in beauty exalted, as it is itself of substance and of fabric more divine.
The Prelude by William Wordsworth was read by Sir Ian McKellen. The programme was recorded at Dove Cottage in the Lake District. We also heard from Robert Wolfe, the director of the Wordsworth Trust. The producer in Manchester was Susan Roberts.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. This is the Crime and Thrillers Hour. Nigel Haver stars in the first part of Proof by Dick Francis in half an hour after a final down payment on death. That's next. We'll hear about the top secret war work of pigeons during the Second World War in the 4 o'clock show. Then later tonight, we're invited round Arthur Smith's with Paul Sinha, Pippa Evans and Milton Jones. Arthur Smith's Ballam Bash is at 10:30. Now, Ewan Griffith and Helen McCrory star in part two of our dramatisation of the first in the great comic sequence of P.G. Woodhouse's Blandings novels. Written just prior to the First World War, it's a masterly portrait of above-stairs angst among the aristocrats and pretensions downstairs.
Something Fresh by P.G. Woodhouse, with Ewan Griffith, Helen McCrory, Hector Elizondo, Jared Harris, James Frayne, Matthew Wolfe, Martin Jarvis and Ian Ogilvie as Woodhouse.
Ash Marson's astonishment was short-lived. There was something about this girl, Joan Valentine, that made the most bizarre happenings seem right and natural. It was strange, certainly, that she should be here in the pitch-dark hall of Blandings Castle in the middle of the night. But after all, no stranger than that he should be.
Don't be alarmed, Mr. Marson.
Oh, no.
I can explain. I know why you're here as Mr. Peter's valet.
What?
For the same reason as I am.
You don't mean to say...
Yes, to earn the £1,000 from Mr. Peter's. We are rivals.
You are here to get the scarab back?
Exactly.
But hang on. You are a young man of good appearance.
What?
The advertisement.
No. Aileen Peters is an old friend of mine. She told me her father would give a large reward to whoever recovered the scarab from Lord Emsworth's museum. So that's why I'm here as her maid. Name of Simpson.
Look out. Run. There's someone coming down the staircase.
But...
Go on, scoot. Oh. I have a cover story.
Good night.
Who's that? Who's there?
Ah, illumination.
Hello?
It's you, is it, Marson? What are you doing here?
Mr. Peters rang for me, sir.
Rang for you? At gone 2 in the morning?
To read to him, sir.
At this hour?
Mr. Peters suffers from insomnia, sir. He has a weak digestion and pain sometimes prevents him from sleeping. The lining of his stomach is not at all what it should be.
I don't believe a word of it.
Well, here is the book I'm about to read to him. If you'd excuse me, I'd better be going up to his room. Good night, sir.
Who's there?
I've come to read to you.
You fool! Don't you know I've just managed to get to sleep?
And now you're awake again. Such is life. I hope you like this novel. I dipped into it. It seems good.
What do you mean by coming in here at this time of night? Are you crazy?
It was your suggestion. And by the way, it worked like a charm.
Well, did you get it? Have you been after my Cheops?
I have been after your Cheops, but I didn't get it. Bad men were abroad. That fellow with a spectacle swooped down from nowhere. Fortunately, I had this novel on me. I think he followed me upstairs to see whether I really did come to your room.
Oh, that's Baxter, Lord Emsworth's private secretary. He'll be setting guard now, you bet your life.
Well, never mind. Make yourself comfortable, and I'll start reading. Shall I begin? If the management of the Hotel Guelph, that London landmark, could have been present at 3 o'clock one afternoon in early January, in the sitting room...
Well, good morning, Mr. Marson.
And a very good morning to you, Miss Valentine. Shall we walk out into the open somewhere where we can't be overheard?
Perhaps it would be better.
Tell me, was I dreaming, or did I really meet you in the hall this morning just after 2?
You did.
And did you really tell me that you'd come to the castle to steal Mr. Peter's...
Recover
Mr. Peter's scarab?
I did.
I suppose you were surprised when you found that I was on the same game as yourself.
Not in the least. I knew it directly I saw the advertisement in the Morning Post.
You've known all along?
I have.
You know, you're wonderful.
Because I saw through you?
Partly that, but chiefly because you had the pluck to undertake a thing like this.
Well, you undertook it.
But I'm a man.
And I'm a woman. And my theory is, Mr. Marson, that a woman can do nearly everything better than a man. What a splendid test case this would make, to settle the votes for women question once and for all. Suppose I beat you. How about the inferiority of women then?
I never said women were inferior.
You did, with your eye.
Besides, you're an exceptional woman.
You can't get out of it with a compliment. I'm an ordinary woman, and I'm going to beat a real man.
I don't like to think of ourselves as working against each other.
Why not?
Because I like you.
Mr. Marson, we mustn't let sentiment interfere with business. You want Mr. Peter's £1,000, so do I. Shall we sit here by the lake? Think of me as though I were another man. I don't want any special privileges. Do you understand?
I suppose so.
We shall need to do our best. That little man with the glasses is on his guard. I was listening to you last night from behind the door. By the way, you shouldn't have told me to run away and then stayed yourself to be caught. That was chivalry, not business.
I had a story ready to account for my being there. You had not.
Not a capital story it was. I shall borrow it. If I'm caught, I shall say I had to read Aileen to sleep because she suffers from insomnia. Oh, I shouldn't wonder if she did, poor girl. She doesn't get enough to eat. My belief is that it's all because she's afraid to make a stand against her father. But back to my point. I want that money, but I don't want it handed to me.
Oh, believe me, it will not be handed to you. I fancy Baxter proposes to camp out on the rug in front of the museum door.
And I thought it was going to be so simple.
I think we should give him a night or two to simmer down.
At least.
Well, let us look on the bright side. Blandings Castle is quite as comfortable as No. 7 Arundel Street. So far as I'm concerned... Let this life continue indefinitely. By the way, have you actually seen the scarab?
Yes. It was dreadful to feel that it was lying there in the open, waiting for somebody to take it and not be able to do anything.
I know. It isn't much to look at, is it? If it hadn't been for the label, I wouldn't have believed Peters was offering $5,000 reward for it. But ours not to reason why. Ours but to elude Baxter and gather it in.
Ours? You speak as though we were partners instead of rivals.
Hey, why not? Why any cutthroat competition? Why shouldn't we form a company?
You mean divide the reward?
Exactly, into 2 equal parts.
And the labour? How shall we divide that?
My idea was that I should do the rough work.
You mean that you should do the actual taking of the scarab?
Exactly. I would look after that end of it.
Oh, and what would my duties be?
Well, you would, as it were... Lend moral support.
By lying snugly in bed fast asleep?
Well...
While you ran all the risks?
No, the risks are practically non-existent.
That's not what you said just now. It won't do, Mr. Marson. You remind me of an old cat I once had. Whenever he killed a mouse, he would bring it into the drawing room and lay it affectionately at my feet. I would reject the corpse with horror and turn him out, but back he would come with his loathsome gift. I simply couldn't make him understand he was not doing me a kindness. You're just the same with your chivalry. It's very kind of you to keep offering me your dead mouse, but honestly, I have no use for it. I won't take favours just because I happen to be a female.
You're very resolute.
Listen, Mr. Marson, if you attempt to work off your dead mouse on me, this partnership ceases before it's begun. If we're to work together, we're going to make alternate attempts to get the scarab.
Then I claim the right to make the first one.
No. We toss for it. Oh,
look, this is perfectly ridiculous.
Heads or tails?
Tails.
Tails it is. What a nuisance. Well, never mind. I'll get my chance if you fail.
I shan't fail. Thank heaven there's no chance now of your doing anything foolish.
Well, don't be too sure. Well, good luck.
Thank you, partner. Shake on it?
Right. Good morning. Oh, there is just one thing, Mr. Marson.
Yes?
If I could have accepted the mouse from anyone, I should certainly have accepted it from you.
Look at them all down there. Call that a house party. 4 days of torpor. They've got that look you see in the saloon of an Atlantic liner, as if they're all about to yawn and look at their watches. Ah, I was wondering when you were going to admit it.
Admit what?
That the idea of being stuck for life with this crowd like a fly on flypaper is too much for you. That you are ready to break off your engagement to Freddie and come away and marry me and live happily ever after.
George!
Well, wasn't that what that sigh meant? Be honest, Aileen.
I didn't sigh. I was just breathing.
Oh, then you can breathe in this atmosphere. Look at them, crawling around the terrace like doped beetles. My dear girl, you're thinner and paler since you came here. Heavens, how we shall thank our stars that we're out of it, when we're settled down happily in Hong Kong. Something's going on there all the time.
George, you really mustn't talk like that when we are both enjoying the hospitality.
Enjoying?
Oh, look, there goes Father, down the steps to the lawn. How fast he is walking. George, have you noticed a sort of difference in Father these last few days?
I haven't. My speciality is keeping an eye on the rest of the Peters family.
He seems better, somehow. He's almost stopped smoking, and he's taking more exercise. The other morning I met his valet going in with a pair of Indian clubs.
About time, too. And how much longer are you going to go on starving yourself to death just to give him the resolution to stick to his dieting? It maddens me to see you at dinner.
I do get a little hungry sometimes. Late at night, generally.
Aileen, you want somebody to take care of you. I can tell you're weakening on this Freddy foolery. I couldn't have loved you all this time and not know.
I'm not weakening. You take too much for granted. And I wish you wouldn't call him Freddy.
He asked me to.
Well, never mind. Please don't do it.
Very well, little girl. Of course. I wouldn't do anything to hurt you.
Add the water? Cover closely and cook very slowly. Then add the seasoning and place the potatoes on top of the meat. Cover and cook until the potatoes are tender but not falling to pieces.
Sure, not falling to pieces, that's right. Pass me another pillow. Now read me the one where it tells about curried lobster.
Curried lobster. Way of preparing. Cream the butter and flour and add the scalded milk. Remove the lobster meat from the shells and cut into half-inch cubes.
Half-inch cubes. Yes?
Add the latter to the sauce.
The latter? Well, what's that? You didn't say anything about the latter. Oh, I see. It means the half-inch cubes. Yes?
Refill the lobster shells, cover with buttered crumbs, and bake until the crumbs are brown. This will serve 6 persons.
And make them feel an hour afterward as though they had swallowed a live wildcat.
Not necessarily. I could eat 2 portions of that at this very minute and go off to bed and sleep like a little child.
I must say, Marson, you're a wonder. You're fresh and you have no respect for your elders and betters, but you deliver the goods. Say, do you know, I felt a new muscle in the small of my back this morning. They're coming out of me like a rash.
That's the Larson exercises. They develop the whole body.
Well, you're a pretty good advertisement for them. What were you before you came to me? A prize fighter?
No, I used to write detective stories.
What you ought to be doing is running a fitness place over here in England like Muldoon has back home. When are you going to have another try for my scarab?
Tonight.
Tonight? How about Baxter?
I shall have to risk Baxter.
See here. I'm beginning to like you. I don't want to get you into trouble. Let the old scarab go. What's a scarab, anyway? Forget about it. And stick on here as my private Muldoon. If it's the 5,000 that's worrying you, I'll give it to you as your fee.
What? I wouldn't think of it.
I know how you feel about the thing, and I'm going to get it for you if I have to wring Baxter's neck. We've given him a few nights to cool off. I expect he's in bed dreaming pleasant dreams. Look, it's nearly 2 o'clock. I'll wait a few more minutes and then go down. Lie back, make yourself comfortable, and I'll read you to sleep first.
You're a good boy.
Are you ready? Pork tenderloin larded. 1/2 pound fat pork.
Fat pork.
4 large pork tenderloins. 2 tablespoonfuls butter. 1 teaspoonful poultry seasoning. Wipe the tenderloins with a damp cloth. Cut your pork into long, thin strips and lard each tenderloin. Melt the butter in the water. Good.
George Emerson sat in his bedroom smoking a cigarette. A light of resolution was in his eyes. A speech of Aileen's had come back to him.
I do get a little hungry sometimes. Late at night, generally.
All right. Problem solved. Food shall be brought to her late at night.
It was nearly 2 in the morning. He gathered up a hefty cut of cold tongue, some bread, a knife, fork, salt, corkscrew, and the bottle of white wine, all of which he purchased earlier that day in Market Blandings.
House must be asleep by now.
The darkness was pitch black as he stole downstairs.
Burglar, eh? Take that. I'm no burglar. You must be.
What's going on? I can hear you. I know what you're up to. I know what you're after.
You villain! Wait till I.
What's this? Clammy. Ice cold. Oh, no. No. Not alive. Oh, God. Help. Help. Murder! Murder!
Look here. Oh, can't see a thing. I say, what's going on down there? Burglars? In heaven's name, stand aside, everybody. I have a shotgun.
Stand back.
Let me go first, Frederick.
Oh, yes, sound scheme, Governor. I won't thrust myself forward. By all means, Clarence, undoubtedly precede us.
Yes, bless my son. I'm familiar with the layout. Sense of touch. Stay behind me, Colonel.
Certainly, Lord Emperor, certainly. Take care in the dark.
Oh, Horace.
What? What's the blackguard saying? There's probably some secret signal to his confederate. All right. Stand back. Stand back. I'm opening fire.
Look out.
Reloading. Now then. Come along. Who's there? Speak, I say.
I think you've killed him, Governor.
Switch on those dashed lights. Wait, doesn't somebody dash it?
Yes, well, please, somebody find switch down the lights.
Right. I do assure you, gentlemen.
Oh, is that you, Beach? Good man, good man.
It's all right. Everything's under control. Here's a switch. Pink silk pajamas, Mr. Beach. Most becoming.
Here, look. It's Mr. Noel Baxter.
Baxter, my dear fellow, what the devil are you doing? Why are you lying there next to a cut of cold tongue?
What
do you mean,
No, he's moving. He's not dead then.
I must say, Baxter, it's extremely fortunate for you that you were prostrated in the darkness, out of my line of fire. Undoubtedly saved me the worry of engaging a new secretary. Well, now get up.
Lord Emsworth, I can explain.
What are all these comestibles? My dear Baxter, if your hunger is so great you're unable to wait for breakfast and have to raid my larder in the middle of the night, I wish to goodness you'd contrive to make less noise about it. Why are you wearing an overcoat?
Old M's wear.
I do not grudge you the food, not even the prodigious cut of cold tongue lying beside you, but do remember that people who have not such keen appetites as yourself like to sleep during the night. Far better plan, my dear fellow, would be to have sandwiches or buns or whatever you consider most sustaining sent up to your bedroom.
Lord Emsworth, I refute such a monstrous accusation. Ladies and gentlemen, I thought in the darkness that what I now discover to be a cut of cold tongue was a lifeless corpse. I believed I knelt in the presence of death.
Pray do not apologize, Baxter. The desire for food is human. It is your boisterous mode of securing and conveying it that I deprecate. Now, let us all go back to bed.
But Lord Emsworth!
Bed! Bed, everybody! Beach, switch off all the lights.
Very good, Master.
All right, everyone, move on. Move on.
Clearly upset.
Greedy pig, stuffing of himself at all hours.
So in the clearer light of this morning, Lord Emsworth, I'm sure you will recognise that I was only acting in your interests and of this museum.
Yeah, just so. My dear fellow, just so.
I do assure you that the true nature of my video
Yes, I quite understand, Bax, but can't you see? I'm engaged in painting this cabinet of birds' eggs. Keep standing in my light.
My lord,
so all I say is, if you do require additional food in the night, let one of the servants bring it to your room before bedtime. Move the paint pot along.
But Lord Emsworth...
No, never mind, my dear fellow. Never mind. Many people like a light snack before actually retiring. Doctors, I believe, sometimes recommend it. Tell me, Baxter, how do you think this museum looks now? Better? With a dash of colour? I think so. Museums are generally such gloomy places.
My lord.
What a deep, rich red this is. And how clean new paint smells. Do you know, Baxter, I've been longing to mess about with paint ever since I was a boy. And now I'm going to my pig.
May I explain once again?
Baxter, you're getting tedious. Out of my way, do you hear?
Mr. Marson, over here, in the still room.
Nobody about?
All cleaning silver in the housekeeper's room, apparently. Mr. Marson, I'm only sorry being a sound sleeper. I wasn't present at the events of the night myself. But thank you. You've cleared the way for me. This is my idea of real teamwork. I'm so glad now that we've formed our partnership. I shall go down and finish the thing off tonight with a clear conscience.
You're thinking of going down to the museum tonight?
Tonight is the one night that there ought to be no risk at all.
After what happened last night? It's madness.
Because of what happened last night. Do you imagine Mr. Baxter will dare to stir from his bed after that?
You're right. Baxter wouldn't risk a second disaster. I'll certainly make a success of it this time.
Mr. Marson, do you propose to try to get the scarab tonight?
Yes.
Aren't you forgetting that by the terms of our agreement, it is my turn?
You surely don't intend to hold me to that.
Certainly I do.
You seriously expect me to lie in bed while you do all the work and then to take a half share in the reward?
I do.
That's ridiculous.
It's no more ridiculous than that I should do the same, Mr. Marson. We settled this long ago.
Well...
Thank you. Good morning.
Next morning, Baxter entered the museum with a presentiment that the worst had happened. It had.
Oh, my God, it's gone. The scarab is gone. Wait. What's this? Ah. Here, you, Marson.
Sir?
The shoes.
I beg your pardon?
I wish to see the servant's shoes. Where are they?
I expect they have them on, sir.
Yesterday's shoes, man. Yesterday's shoes. Where are they?
Where are the shoes of yesteryear? I should say at a venture, sir, that they would be in a large basket somewhere near the kitchen. Our genial knife and shoe boy collects them, I believe, at early dawn.
Would they have been cleaned yet?
If I know the lad, sir, no.
Go and bring that basket to me. Bring it to me in that empty room.
Mr. Beach's pantry, sir? Certainly, sir. Here it is, sir. We have a fair selection of our various foot coverings.
Right. Now. Aha! A splash of red on it.
A female shoe. You see? I do. I do.
Put all the others back.
Yes, sir. That's the lot, sir.
Now come with me. Leave the basket there. You can carry it back when you return.
Shall I put back that shoe, sir?
Certainly not. I shall take this one with me to Lord Emsworth.
Shall I carry it for you, sir?
Yes. Follow me.
No, don't. No, I'm not giving you an apple.
Lord Emsworth? Lord Emsworth?
What? What do you mean by barking at me like that?
Your lordship, the scarab has gone.
You've broken my eardrum, really, Baxter. You're becoming a perfect pest.
Somebody has stolen the scarab which Mr. Peters gave you. It has disappeared.
Really? Bless my soul. Well, this is extremely annoying. Mr. Peters may think I ought to have taken more care of it. Now, who in the world could have stolen that scarab?
A female, Lord Emsworth. Her shoe bears the incriminating evidence of red paint.
Indeed. Dear me, you're certain there was red paint on the shoe?
Yes. I bought it on purpose to show you. You, Marston, the shoe.
Here, my lord.
Ah. This, you say, is... just so. My dear Baxter, it may be that I've not examined this shoe with sufficient care, but can you point out to me exactly where this paint is that you speak of?
What? But there was paint on this shoe, I tell you. This man here will bear me out in this. You saw paint on this shoe.
Paint, sir?
Do you mean to tell me you did not see it?
No, sir. There was no paint on this shoe.
This is ridiculous. I saw it with my own eyes. It was a broad splash right across the toe.
You must have made a mistake, my dear Baxter. These momentary optical delusions are, I fancy, not uncommon. Any doctor will tell you.
I had an aunt, your lordship, who was remarkably...
No, this is absurd. The toe of this shoe was red when I found it.
Oh, it's quite black now, my dear Baxter.
A sort of chameleon shoe.
What did you say?
Nothing, sir.
Look, I strongly suspect you of having had something to do with this.
Now, really, Baxter, this young man could hardly have cleaned the shoe on his way from the house. I can assure you paint does not brush off.
Exactly, your lordship. My theory, if I may...
Yes?
My theory, your lordship, is that Mr. Baxter was deceived by the light and shade effects on the toe of the shoe. The morning sun streaming in through the window must have shone on the shoe in such a manner as to give it a momentary and fictitious aspect of redness.
Oh, nonsense.
Look, Baxter, you're curiously irritating these days. You're an efficient secretary, of course, but the company is tending to become a trifle tedious. It seems to me that is the only explanation that will square with the facts. A shoe that is really smeared with red paint does not become black of itself in the course of a few minutes.
You are very right, your lordship. May I go now, my lord?
Hmm? Yes, certainly, certainly, by all means.
Shall I take the shoe with me, my lord?
If you do not want it, Baxter?
No, I do not want it, your lordship. Here, take it.
Thank you, Mr. Baxter. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
On returning to the butler's pantry, Ash's first act was to retrieve what he was certain must be Joan Valentine's shoe from the basket. He was about to leave the room with it when...
Baxter, I do not in the least understand why you wish me to come in here. You're completely spoiling my morning.
Oh, Lord. Well, nothing for it. Window, shoe, out of.
Ah! You, Lord Emsworth, and I wish to look at the shoes again.
Certainly, sir.
I can manage without your assistance. Stand over there.
Very good, sir.
Don't stand there staring at me.
I was interested in what you were doing, sir.
Never mind. Don't stare at me in that idiotic way.
May I read a book, sir?
Yes. Read a book if you like.
Thank you, sir.
Wait. Raise the tablecloth so I may look beneath the table.
Are you looking for Mr. Beach, sir? I think he's gone to church.
You had better be careful.
Now, my dear Baxter.
What is in this cupboard?
That cupboard, sir?
Yes. This cupboard.
I could not say, sir. Mr. Beach possibly keeps a few odd trifles there.
Open it.
It appears to be locked, sir.
Unlock it.
But where's the key?
Lord Emsworth, I have my reasons for thinking that this man is deliberately keeping the contents of this cupboard from me. I am convinced that the shoe is in there. Have I your leave to break open the door?
Baxter, apparently you accuse this young man of keeping his shoes in a cupboard. If he wishes to do so, why on earth should he not keep his shoes in a cupboard? This is a free country.
Exactly, your lordship. You have touched the spot.
It has all to do with the theft of your scarab, Lord Emsworth. Somebody got into the museum and stole the scarab.
Oh, yes, so they did.
Whoever stole it upset the can of red paint and stepped in it. I suspect this man of shielding the criminal by hiding her shoe in this cupboard.
Oh, it's not his own shoes that this young man keeps in cupboards?
It is a woman's shoe, Lord Emsworth.
The deuce it is. Then it was a woman who stole the scarab. Bless myself, Baxter, one wonders what women are coming to nowadays. It's all this movement, I suppose, of vote, all that.
What I wish to do is to break open this cupboard.
Eh? Why?
To get the shoe.
The shoe?
If your lordship has no objection.
Objection, my dear fellow? No, none in the world. Why should I have any objection? What is it you wish to do?
this with the poker.
We must humour him, a good fellow.
Indeed, your lordship.
Now we'll see.
Allow me. A corkscrew, box of matches, a book, a bottle of embrocation, and other useful and entertaining objects. It contains, in fact, almost everything except a paint-splashed shoe.
Are you satisfied now, Baxter? Or is there any more furniture you'd like to break? You know, this furniture breaking's becoming a positive craze with you, my dear fellow. You ought to fight against it. The night before last, I don't know how many tables broken in the hall. Now this cupboard, you'll ruin me. No purse can stand the constant drain.
Lord Emsworth!
Look at you see? His face is quite flushed with these preposterous exertions, eh, what?
It certainly has a faintly red aspect, my lord.
You, Marston! You will hear more of this.
What's that? Bless my soul.
What?
If you please, your lordship, the Honourable Frederick has fallen downstairs.
Frederick, in the name of goodness, what do you imagine you're doing?
It's that bloody cat. He came legging it up the stairs. I think I've broken my leg.
Well, you've certainly broken everything else. Between you and Baxter, I wonder there's a stick of furniture standing in the house.
Can I help, sir? Kindly, take my arm.
What? Oh, thanks, old chap. I think my bally ankle must have got twisted. Ow! I wish you would give me a hand up to my room.
Baxter, you might telephone to Dr. Bird in Market Blandings. Ask him to be good enough to drive out.
Certainly, your lordship.
Oh, goodness. Everything's so disturbing nowadays.
Put your weight on me, Mr. Frederick. Oh, that's it. You can hop, and I'll do a sort of polka step up the stairs. That's it. And one, and two, and three, and hop. And again, one, and two, and three, and hop. Keep it up. Good work.
Great work, Marston! On my return from church a few months ago, Emsworth informed me the scarab was stolen in the night by some person unknown. Great work, my boy!
I'm sorry, Mr. Peters. I must disclaim all credit for its disappearance.
It wasn't you who got it? What? Who was it, then?
It was Miss Peters' maid. It's a long story, but we were working in partnership. I tried for the thing and failed, and she succeeded.
Well, then go find this incredible girl. I'm writing a check right now.
But
do you hear me? Hustle!
Miss Valentine, I have just left Mr. Peters. All is well. His checkbook lies before him on the table.
Mr. Marston, if you imagine, I shall consent to accept a penny of the reward.
Exactly what I was going to say. I couldn't dream of taking any of it.
What? You're certainly going to have it all. Now that you've broken our agreement, nothing could induce me to take it. I told you ours was a business contract and I wouldn't have any chivalry.
What do you mean?
What do I mean? Why, that you went down to the museum last night before me and took the scarab, though you had promised to stay away and give me my chance.
But I didn't do anything of the sort.
But you have got the scarab, Mr. Marston.
No, you've got it.
No, I haven't.
But it's gone.
Well, I know. I went down to the museum last night, as we had arranged, and when I got there, there was no scarab.
What? You mean it was gone when you got to the museum?
Well, there wasn't a trace of it. I was furious.
But this is ridiculous. Who can have taken it? There was nobody besides ourselves who knew Mr. Peters was offering the reward. What exactly happened last night?
Well, I waited until 1 o'clock. Then I slipped down, got into the museum, struck a match, and looked for the scarab. Nearly skidded on some paint on the floor. Well, the scarab wasn't there. It was gone. So I went back to bed and thought hard thoughts about you. Well, somebody must have taken it. And the question is, what are we to do?
First, I have to go back and tell Peters. It will break his heart.
Aileen, I've been looking for you.
And here I am. Cheer up, George. Whatever is the matter?
Everything.
How do you mean, everything?
Exactly what I say. I'm done for. Read this. A cable. I got it this morning. Read it.
I'm trying to. It doesn't seem to make sense.
Oh, it makes sense, all right.
I don't see how you can say that. Meredith, elephant, kangaroo?
Oh, office cipher, I was forgetting. Elephant means seriously ill and unable to attend to duty. Meredith is the man who was doing my work while I was on leave.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Are you very fond of Mr. Meredith?
Meredith is a good fellow, but unfortunately, kangaroo means return without fail by the next boat.
You must return by the next boat? When is that?
Wednesday morning. I shall have to leave here tomorrow.
But George...
It's bad luck. But I shouldn't wonder if it's not for the best. If this cable hadn't come, I suppose I should have gone on bothering you up to the day of your wedding. This ends me with one punch. I couldn't think any more of you than I do. But if I could, the way that you have put up with my mouthing and swaggering would make me do it. You have been wonderful.
I...
Aileen, I have told you so often that I love you, we have come to make almost a joke of it. But I'm going to say it once again, even though it has come to be sort of a catchphrase. I love you. I'm reconciled to the fact that I'm done for, out of the running, and that you're going to marry Freddy, but I'm not going to stop loving you.
George.
I can't do it. It's just an impossibility, and that's all there is to it. Whatever I may be to you, you are part of me, and you always will be. I might just as well try to go on living without breathing as living without loving you. That's all. I had to say it, but it's the last time. There will be no tragedy when I step into the train tomorrow. Oh, just one thing more. Is there any chance you might come and see me off?
Good heavens, Aileen. What brings you up here?
I came to see how you're feeling, Freddy.
Oh, right. You can sit down if you want to. Try the edge of the bed. It was that Bally Blanding's cat. It came legging it up the stairs and I took the most frightful toss. I hate cats. Do you hate cats? I was just reading this corking book. Have you ever read these things? They come out every month and they're corking. The fellow who writes them must be a corker. It beats me how he thinks them up. They're about a detective chap called Gridley Quayle. Frightfully exciting.
Shall I read to you, Freddy?
Righto, good scheme. I've got to the top of this page.
Seven guns covered him with deadly precision. Did you get as far as that?
Yes, just beyond. This chappy Quayle has been trapped in a lonely house, thinking he was going to see a pal in distress. And instead of the pal, there pop out a whole squad of mask blighters with guns. I don't see how he's going to get out of it, but I'll bet he does. He's a corker. Go on, then.
Gridley Quayle gritted his teeth and squared up to the seven figures bearing down upon him. Little did any of them know that...
Actually, Aileen, I've got a better idea. Would you mind if I just took a look at the rest of it myself? I shan't be long.
Of course. But do you really like this sort of thing, Freddy?
Me, rather. It's corking. Ah, golly. It's all right. He did get out. He had a bomb on him, and he threatened to drop it and blow the place to pieces unless the blighters let him go. So they cheesed it. I knew he had something up his sleeve.
Freddy, do you love me? Freddy, do you love me? Am I a part of you? If you hadn't got me, would it be like trying to go on living without breathing?
Eh? What? Do I... Oh, yes, rather. I say, one of the blighters has just loosed a rattlesnake into Gridley Quayle's bedroom through the transom, whatever that is. Gosh.
Quick, over here, Miss Valentine.
Yes?
The news is, I think Mr. Peters would now part with half his fortune to recover the scarab. He's doubled the existing reward. Do you have any fresh ideas? You may look on me as baffled.
No, but don't give up, Mr. Marson. Between us, we've now lost $10,000 in a single night. Why, I can't afford it. It's like losing a legacy. I absolutely refuse to give in without an effort and go back to home gossip.
Yes, and the prospect of tackling Gridley Quayle again.
Of course. I was forgetting you're a writer of detective stories. You ought to be able to solve this mystery in a moment. Ask yourself, what would Gridley Quayle have done?
Gridley Quayle would have waited helplessly for some coincidence to happen to help him out.
Had he no methods?
Oh, he was full of methods, but they never led him anywhere without the coincidence. However, what time did you get to the museum?
1 a.m.
And you found the scarab gone. What does that suggest to you?
Nothing. What does that suggest to you?
Absolutely nothing. Let's try again. Whoever took the scarab must have had special information that Peters was offering the reward.
Then why hasn't he been to Mr. Peters and claimed it?
True. That would seem to be a flaw in the reasoning. Once again, whoever took it must have been in urgent and immediate need of money.
And how are we to find out who was in urgent and immediate need of money?
Exactly. How indeed?
I should think your Mr. Quayle must have been a great comfort to his clients, wasn't he?
Inductive reasoning, I admit, seems to have fallen down. We must wait for the coincidence. I have a feeling that it will come. I'm very fortunate in the way of coincidences.
Are you?
Was it not a strange coincidence that you should have come into my life at all?
Well, not very. It was quite likely that we should meet sooner or later, as we lived on different floors of the same house.
It was a coincidence that you should have taken that room.
Why?
Well, I don't know, but... Look out, Freddy's valet is coming this way.
Miss Simpson and Mr. Marson. Hey, it's true. What I said that night, there ain't a doubt of it now. It's been and happened just as I said.
What did you say, Jocelyn? Which night?
That night at dinner. The first night you two come here. Don't you remember me talking about Freddy and the girl I used to write the letters to in London? The girl I said was so like you, Miss Simpson. Joan Valentine. The girl at the theatre. Well... She's been and done it like I said she would. She's sticking young Freddy up for his letters. I took a suit of Freddy's clothes away to brush just now, and happening to glance at the contents of his pockets, I come across a letter. It was from a fellow named Jones, and it said that this girl, Valentine, was holding on to young Freddy's letters what he'd written her, and would see him blowed if she parted with them for under another 1,000. As I made out, Freddy's already given her 500.
Oh, really?
This fella Jones said he passed it on to her with his own hands. But she wasn't satisfied, and if she didn't get another 1,000, she's going to bring an action for breach. And now Freddy's given me a note to take to this Jones, who's stopping in Market Blandings.
But that can't be true.
Saw the letter with my own eyes, Miss Simpson.
But...
It shows that he was in immediate and urgent need of money.
You bet it does. My word. There won't half be a kick-up if she does sue him for breach. I'm off to tell Mr. Beach and the rest, or they'll jump out their skins. Oh, Lord, I was forgetting this note. He told me to take it at once.
I'll take it for you. I'm not doing anything.
You're a good fellow, Marson. I'll do as much for you another time. He's staying at the Emsworth Arms. I couldn't hardly bear not to tell a bit of news like this right away. Oh, I should burst or something. Thanks.
I simply can't understand it. My head's going round.
Why, it's perfectly clear. This is the coincidence for which, in my capacity of Gridley Quayle, I was waiting. I can now resume inductive reasoning. And what do we find? That Freddy is the man. He has the scarab.
But I'm not holding his letters.
For Jones's purposes, you are. What do you know of him?
He was an enormously fat man who came to see me one night and said he'd been sent to get back some letters. I told him I'd destroyed them ages ago, and he went away.
Well, that part of it is clear, then. He is working a simple but ingenious game on Freddy, who seems to have accepted the story without a murmur. What does Freddy do? He has to raise £1,000 immediately, and the raising of the first 500 has exhausted his credit. He gets the idea of stealing the scarab.
But why? He couldn't have known that Mr. Peters was offering a reward. He couldn't have known anything.
Wait, I have it. Jones must have known about the scarab and told him.
But how could he have known? He couldn't. He'd gone by the time Aileen came to see me that night.
Which night?
Well, the night of the day I first met you. I was wondering for a moment whether he could have by chance overheard Aileen telling me about the scarab and the reward.
Overheard? That word is like a bugle blast to me. 9 out of 10 of Gridley Quayle's triumphs were due to his having overheard something.
How could he have overheard us? The door was closed.
Did you see him out?
No, but he went.
He might have waited on the stairs. You remember how dark they are at number 7? And listened.
Why?
Why? Great Scott, I'll tell you why. I see it all. His object in coming to see you about the letters was because Freddy wanted them back owing to his approaching marriage with Miss Peters, wasn't it?
Yes.
You tell him you have destroyed the letters, he goes off. Am I right?
Yes. In fact, he sort of crossed over with Aileen on the landing.
Well, there you are. He waits until Miss Peters has gone into your room, then just stands outside and listens. How about that?
Yes. He might quite easily have done that.
He did do exactly that. I know it as though I had been there. In fact, it is highly probable I was there. I remember coming down the stairs that night. I was going out to a vaudeville show and hearing voices in your room. In all probability, I nearly ran into Jones.
It does seem to fit in, doesn't it?
It's a clear case. Now, the only question is, can I, on the evidence, go to young Freddy and choke the scarab out of him?
On the whole, I think I'd better take this note to Jones first and see whether I can't work something through him. Yes, that's the best plan. I'll be starting at once. Well done, Mike.
Mike?
Never mind. I use the word figuratively.
What?
Bye.
Come in. Oh, I know who you are. You're the chap who helped me up the stairs.
That's right.
What do you want? What are you staring at me like that for?
I will tell you. If you can spare me a few moments of your valuable time, I will put the facts before you.
Now look here!
Yes, press that bell if you wish. Lord Emsworth will no doubt be pleased to learn that his son, whom he trusted, is a thief.
Oh? What do you mean?
I will tell you what I mean. On Saturday night, a valuable scarab was stolen from Lord Emsworth's private museum. The case was put into my hands.
I say, are you a detective?
Ah.
Golly, all these years I've wanted to meet a detective, and now that my wish has been gratified, the detective seems to be detecting me.
The case was placed in my hands. I investigated it. I discovered that you were in urgent and immediate need of money.
How on earth did you do that?
I further discovered that you were in communication with an individual named Jones.
Good Lord! How?
Yesterday I had a talk with this man Jones, who is staying in Market Blandings. Why is he staying in Market Blandings? Because he had a reason for keeping in touch with you. Because you were about to transfer to his care something you could get possession of, but which only he could dispose of. The scarab.
Golly!
I interviewed this man Jones. I said to him, I am in the Honourable Frederick Threepwood's confidence. I know everything. Have you any instructions for me? He replied, what do you know? I answered, I know that Threepwood has something he wishes to hand to you, but which he has been unable to hand to you, owing to having had an accident and being confined to his room. He then told me to tell you to let him have the scarab by messenger.
I say, you know, I think it's bally marvellous the way you've deduced everything and so on.
Well?
But I believe you would chuck it if you heard my side of the case.
I know your side of the case. You think you're being blackmailed by a Miss Valentine. You are not. Miss Valentine has destroyed the letters. She told the man Jones so when he went to see her in London. He kept your £500 for himself and is trying to get another 1,000 out of you under false pretenses.
What? You can't be right.
I'm always right.
You must be mistaken.
I'm never mistaken.
So she isn't going to sue me for breach of promise?
She never had any intention of doing so.
Oh, good egg. This is a bit of all right. I say, you don't mean to say that that rotter Jones was such a rotter as to do a rotten thing like that?
I do.
I trusted that man.
I know. There is one born every minute.
Dash it. I'll tell you what I'll do. The very next time I meet the blighter, I'll cut him dead. 500 quid he's had off me for nothing. And to think that if it hadn't been for you...
Never mind that. Give me the scarab. Where is it?
What are you going to do with it?
Restore it to its rightful owner.
Are you going to give me away to the governor?
I'm not.
It strikes me that you are a dashed good sort. It's under the mattress.
Ah, yes. Here it is. Can hardly believe it. A small fortune.
You know, I've always wanted to meet a detective. What beats me is how you chappies find out things.
We have our methods.
I say, I wonder whether you've ever read any of these things, these Gridley Quail stories.
I know them by heart.
Do you read them?
I should say not. I write them.
What? Hey! You write them? You don't mean you write them?
Yes.
Great Scott! Great...
I say, Frederick, my boy.
Frederick, old man.
What's this? A deputation? Excuse me?
What? Now, look here, I suppose you've come to inquire after my ankle. And actually, I'm thankful you've all come in a bally body instead of one by bally one. Oh, what ho, Baxter. I say, what's up?
Frederick, my dear boy, I fear we have a painful task to perform.
Painful? Oh, Lord. I don't know what you mean.
Of course you don't, Dashit. We're coming to that.
Oh, what ho, Colonel Mant. You still here?
And I should like to begin by saying that, though in a sense it was my fault, I failed to see how I could have acted.
Horace, I was only trying to explain.
Freddie, my boy.
It's quite straightforward. Miss Peters has eloped with your friend George Emerson.
Exactly, Baxter. Precisely, you put the thing in a nutshell. Really, my dear fellow, you're invaluable. Well, my boy.
Eh? What?
Yeah, I'm afraid it's true, Frederick. She went to London with him on the 10:50.
And if I had not been forcibly restrained by the Colonel here, I could have prevented it.
It was a most unfortunate misunderstanding, Freddo. I chanced to be at the station bookstall when the train came in. Mr. Baxter was also at the station. The train pulled up and this young fellow Emerson got in. Just as the train was about to start, Miss Peters, exclaiming, "George, dear, I'm going with you, dash it," proceeded to go hell for leather for the door of young Emerson's compartment, upon which
I made a spring to try and catch her. Far from any further consideration, the train was already moving and Miss Peters ran a considerable risk of injury. I had hardly moved when I felt a violent jerk at my ankle and fell to the ground. After I had recovered from the shock, I found...
The fact is, Freddy, my boy, I acted under a misapprehension. Recent events in this house had left me with the impression that Mr. Baxter here was not quite responsible for his actions. Of course, I now realise my mistake, and I have apologised, humbly, dash it. But at the moment, I was firmly under the impression that our friend here had an attack of some kind and was about to inflict injuries on Miss Peters. I've seen it happen in India a dozen times. I sprang forward and caught the crook of my walking stick on Mr. Baxter's ankle and brought him down. And by the time explanations were made, it was too late. The train had gone with Miss Peters in it.
And a telegram has just arrived to say that they are being married this afternoon at a registrar's. The whole occurrence is most disturbing.
Bear it like a man, my boy.
So you mean to say Aileen has bolted with Emerson?
Yes.
Well, I'm blowed. Fancy that. Phew.
Marson, pack.
Pack?
Pack. We're getting out of here by the afternoon train.
Has anything happened?
My daughter has eloped with Emerson.
What?
Don't stand there saying what. Pack.
Then where shall I put this?
What? Oh! You got it!
I got it.
Where was it? How did you choke it out of them? Who took it?
I don't know whether I ought to say. You won't tell anyone.
Tell anyone? What do you take me for? If I can sneak out without that fellow Baxter jumping on my back, I shall be satisfied. Who had it?
Young Freddy Threepwood.
Threepwood? Why did he want it?
He needed money, and he was going to raise it on this.
What? And I have been kicking because Aileen can't marry him and has gone off with a regular fellow like young Emerson? He'll make a name for himself one of these days, young Emerson. He's got get-up in him. Why, if Aileen had married Threepwood, I should have had grandchildren who would have sneaked my watch while I was dancing them on my knee. There's a taint in the whole family. Father sneaks my keops, and Sonny sneaks it from father. What a gang! If property isn't safe here, I'm going back to America on the next boat. Now, where's my checkbook?
Here, sir. Allow me.
Oh, I'm going to write you that check right away. You've earned it.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, now, listen, young man. I don't know what your plans are. I'll make it worth your while to stay on with me. I'm feeling better now than I have felt in years, and you've only just started in on me. How about it?
Well, I have to say that appeals both to my commercial and my missionary instincts, but... I may have to talk to somebody. Let me think it over.
Well, think quick.
Joan! Miss Valentine! I mean, Simpson!
Oh. Hello.
What is it? What is the matter?
Gloom. Despondency. A sort of flat feeling. Don't you hate things happening?
I don't quite understand.
Well, this affair of Aileen, for instance. So big it makes one feel as if the whole world had altered. I should like nothing to happen ever, and life just jog peacefully along. It's not the gospel I preached to you in Arundel Street, is it? I thought I was an advanced apostle of action. But I seem to have changed. I can see that you don't in the least understand what I mean.
Yes, I do. Well, I think I do. What it comes to is that somebody you were fond of has gone out of your life. Hong Kong and all that.
Yes. At least, that's partly it. I didn't really know Aileen particularly well, beyond having been at school with her, but you're right. I mean, it's not so much what's happened as what it represents that matters. This elopement has marked the end of a phase in my life. My life has been such a series of jerks. I dash along, then something happens which stops that bit of my life with a jerk. I think I'm getting tired of jerks. I want something continuous. Do you ever get moods when life seems absolutely meaningless? It's like a badly constructed story, with all sorts of characters moving in and out who have nothing to do with the plot, and somebody comes along that you think really has something to do with the plot, and then suddenly drops out. And after a while, you're beginning to wonder what the story's about, and you feel it's about nothing, just a jumble.
There is one thing that knits it together.
What's that?
The love interest. Joan, will you marry me?
What?
I'm sorry, Freddy, my dear boy. I fear this is rather a mess.
Oh, what? Yes, rather. Deuce of a shock, Governor.
I've been thinking it over, my boy. And perhaps I have been a little hard on you. When your ankle is better, I've decided to renew your allowance. And you may return to London, as you don't seem happy in the country. Though how any reasonable being can prefer the town to the country, I really can't imagine.
My word! Not really!
Oh, yes, to be sure, yes. Yeah, but, Freddy, my boy, I do wish that this time you would endeavour not to make a damned fool of yourself. Hmm?
Governor, I'll have a jolly good stab at it.
Sorry, I just thought I'd ask.
Marry you? You think that that's the solution? We scarcely know each other. I shan't always be in this mood. I may get restless again. I may find it's the jerks that I really like.
You won't.
Well, you're very confident.
I'm absolutely confident.
She travels fastest who travels alone.
What's the good of travelling fast if you're going round in a circle? I know how you feel. I felt the same myself. You're an individualist. You think there is something tremendous just round the corner and you can get it if you try hard enough. There isn't. Or if there is, it isn't worth getting. Life is nothing but a mutual aid association. I'm going to help old Peters. You're going to help me. I'm going to help you.
Help me do what?
Make life coherent instead of a jumble.
Mr. Marson.
Don't call me Mr. Marson.
Well, Ash, you don't know me. I've been knocking about the world for 5 years and I'm hard. Hard right through. I should make you wretched.
You're not in the least hard, and you know it. Listen to me, Joan. Where's your sense of fairness? You crash into my life, turn it upside down, dig me out of my quiet groove, revolutionise my whole existence, and now you propose to drop me and pay no further attention to me? Is it fair?
But I don't. We shall always be the best of friends.
We shall. But we will get married first.
You're determined.
I am.
Oh, how perfectly splendid. Oh, I was terrified lest I might have made you change your mind. Oh, I had to say all I did to preserve my self-respect after proposing to you.
What?
Well, yes, I did. How strange it is that men never seem to understand a woman, however plainly she talks. You don't think I was really worrying because I'd lost Aileen, do you? I thought I was going to lose you, and it made me miserable. You couldn't expect me to say so in so many words. But I thought you guessed. But I practically said it.
Ash, what are you doing?
I'm dizzying you.
But you mustn't. There's a scullery maid or somebody looking through the kitchen window. She'll see us.
Well, scullery maids have few pleasures. Theirs is a dull life. Let her see us. It'll be something fresh for her.
Ah, yes. Something fresh.
In the second and final part of Something Fresh by P.G. Wodehouse, Ash Marson was played by Ewan Griffith and Joan Valentine by Helen McCrory. J. Preston Peters was played by Hector Elizondo, Rupert Baxter by Jared Harris, the Hon. Freddie Threepwood, Matthew Wolfe, and the Earl of Emsworth, Martin Jarvis. George Emerson, James Frayne, Aileen Peters, Andrea Bowen, Beach, Morgan Shepherd, Colonel Mant, Kenneth Danziger, Mr. Judson, Darren Richardson, and guests and servants were played by Alan Shearman and Maura Quirk. Ian Ogilvy was the voice of P.G. Wodehouse. Something Fresh was dramatised by Archie Scottney, directed by Martin Jarvis, and is a Jarvis and Ayres production for BBC Radio 4.
Well, now, on Monday at this time, we begin a four-part adaptation of a Wilkie Collins classic. Written in 1859 and considered to be among the first mystery novels, The Woman in White is the story of a young teacher, Walter Hartwright, who's dispatched to Cumberland to teach the two sisters of Limeridge House. But an encounter with a troubled woman alters his relationship with the family. Every afternoon next week here on 4 Extra, you can hear Khaled Hosseini's The Kite Runner. It's a modern classic which tells the story of two young boys who unite over a shared passion for the fierce Afghan sport of kite fighting.
Every district in Kabul held a kite fighting tournament. And if you were a boy living in Kabul, the day of the tournament was the highlight of the season. Hassan and I spent hours making our own string, or tar. We'd feed up to 500 feet of it through a mixture of ground glass and glue and then wind it round a wooden spool. By the time the snow melted, every boy in Kabul bore telltale horizontal gashes on his fingers from a winter of fighting kites.
But when it's tested by much bigger battles than kite fighting, will the friendship of Amir and Hassan survive? Kulvinder Gear reads The Kite Runner, starting on Monday afternoon at 2:15, here on Radio 4 Extra.
The great gardener Gertrude Jekyll once said, "A garden is a grand teacher. It teaches patience, it teaches industry and thrift."
In a day and age where everything is so easily available, I love Christmas pudding. Could not eat it every day. It's wonderful because it's only around for a week or two, and that's the wonderful thing about gardening.
Above all, it teaches entire trust.
Personally speaking, what gardening has taught me is that I never want to work in an office again.
Bravo.
Penelope Keith presents 3 hours of horticultural highlights from the BBC Sound Archives. 4 Extra goes gardening this Saturday morning at 9 o'clock and again in the evening at 7.
Mel's here next. I'll see you at 5 with Hudwinks and our legal comedy Chambers.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, it's me, Mel Gederich, and this is Friday's 4 o'clock show. Get your bags packed. I hope your passport's up to date. Have you got the correct visa? Because we're all going to New York, New York, to see the most amazing sight. A giant peach is stuck on the top of the Empire State Building. But that's not all.
Suddenly, the great brown head of the centipede appeared over the side of the peach. His black eyes, as large and round as two marbles, glared down at the policeman and the fireman below. Three firemen and five policemen fainted and had to be carried away.
Today's 4 o'clock show is the final chapter of Roald Dahl's fantastical James and the Giant Peach, read exclusively for us by Miriam Margolyes. Stay tuned to find out if James and his giant insect pals get down from the top of that skyscraper in one piece. We hear from a real New Yorker.
"By the time I get finished with you, you are going to beg for mercy. You're going to say, 'Please let me out of this cab.' You're going to have a wonderful time. Come on, let me show you my city."
The Gabby Cabby coming up later. And we hear about the amazing life-saving exploits of some spies of the feathered variety.
One of her pigeons flew three different journeys and he was given a Dicking medal.
The medal for valour?
Any pigeon that won them medals had got to be on something to save lives.
The top secret work of homing pigeons during World War II, all coming up on today's 4 o'clock show. But listen up, before we do anything else, we've got a magical mystery tour to begin. On my magical mystery tour, I don't know if I've ever said this to you. Have I ever said... I'll tell you anyway. Your job is to work out our destination from the clues I give you throughout the show. Today's first clue is, we're going to a newish London landmark that has enough glass panels to cover 8 football pitches. Where are we going? More clues coming up later in the show. Stay tuned.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud, he's got radio.
My friends, we are off to New York. My spidey sense is all tingly because we're about to go high above the streets of Manhattan for a walk along the High Line. This is an old elevated railway line, which used to carry freight up and down the west side of Manhattan, 30 foot above the streets. Years after it fell into disuse, New Yorkers got together to save a mile-long stretch from demolition, and it was transformed into what's called an aerial park, which is a sort of green walkway above Manhattan. Doesn't it sound gorgeous? Well, lucky Anna Magnusson went for a Spider-Man's eye view of the city with Richard McCaffrey, who moved to New York from Glasgow 13 years ago. By the way, it is a little bit of a windy day on the High Line. Hope they don't get blown off.
We're following the route of the railway, laid out on this sort of walkway, and there are old glimpses of the railway lines on either side. But we are absolutely in the heart of a city, an urban landscape. There are buildings sort of rising around all about us, and some are so near that you could reach out and touch them.
I think we're like the equivalent of three stories above street level. That's like 25, 30 feet, which isn't that high really, but it's high enough to give us a completely different experience than you would have from street level. From street level, you're in amongst the hustle and the bustle, but here we're detached, we're removed from the city, but yet we're still connected to it. And we're walking through the buildings. We're actually walking under a building that has been developed
around it,
above the High Line. And that's what we can see.